This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There were three ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take?" With a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Three Ravens podcast. This one dedicated to the winners of our Folky Flash Fiction competition.
Whoop woo!
And as we said last week, if you haven't been following the podcast for very long, the stories we're reading today were all written by members of the Three Ravens community during Series 3 to the brief that they had to be 1,000 words long, about something folkloric, and emailed to us at our usual address, threeravenspodcast@gmail.com.
As we mentioned in last week's runners-up episode, alas, some of the entries we received were really good, but far too long, so disqualified. Top marks for trying it on, particularly those of you who save things as PDFs. But in spite of the rumours, we can count.
Well, sort of. Well, since that radiation spill, Martin's had so many toes, we can count up to over 3,000. You're like a human abacus, aren't you?
I am. And again, thank you so much to the dozens of people who entered the competition and for all the effort you put into your stories. We had a lovely time reading them all, but we've settled on 7 winners. And this episode, we're going to tell those tales.
And this, would you believe, is the final episode of the gap between Series 3 and Series 4, mm-hmm. meaning next week, we'll be back with a brand new Three Ravens episode. We're kicking off in Suffolk this time round, and we'll be back releasing Thursday bonus episodes, plus some new stuff as well that we will talk about in episode 0.
Yep. Now, to all those people who've written to us saying, "More Three Ravens, please," be careful what you wish for, because More Three Ravens is coming down the pipe like a tidal wave of inky black folky goodness. Just open your ear holes, as here we come.
Before then, though, we'll just flag up that last Thursday, we released our Patreon exclusive episode for the month, Three Lost Villages, which sees Martin and I zooming around Sussex looking for ruined and vanished places and telling the stories of what happened to them.
Yep.
And next week, we'll be releasing our brand new Three Ravens Film Club episode, all about the 2022 folk horror movie Men.
Yep, if you're unfamiliar with Three Ravens Film Club, we encourage everyone in the Three Ravens community to watch a film each month, everybody watching the same one, each one being a kind of culty, folky, fairy tale type film. Last month it was the 1968 Hammer horror classic The Devil Rides Out, and this month it's a modern one, Men, written and directed by Alex Garland,
the same chap who made Ex Machina, who wrote 28 Days Later, and whose new film Civil War is also out this month.
So if you fancy a bit of folk horror in your life, watch Men, then email us what you thought of it to threeravenspodcast@gmail.com, and we'll include your thoughts in our Three Ravens Film Club episode about the film, which will be out exclusively exclusively on Patreon at patreon.com/3ravenspodcast.
And if you'd like a whole big back catalogue of exclusive content plus ad-free listening, our monthly newsletter packed full of folky goodness and much more.
Plus, to be one of the people who helps support us and keep Three Ravens running.
True. Anyhow, do sign up to the Patreon for $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/3ravenspodcast.
As we mentioned last week, we are planning a new writing contest to take place during Series 4. More news on that in Episode 0 next week. So if your story didn't make it into our runner-up or winners categories, fear not, more chances are coming.
For now, though, shall we read those wonderful nuggets of folky flash fiction?
We should and must and will. And to decide who goes first, once again, let's flip a coin.
And again, like last time, these stories are in no particular rank order. We just thought they'd sound nice this way.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, I'm going to call Tails.
Very well. Tails never fails. Let's see what happens.
And?
It's Tails!
Woohoo!
Meaning you're going first. So, Eleanor, take it away with our first winner.
Worth His Salt by Lissa Sloane. He didn't think she would stay, this unearthly girl he'd found high in the branches of an ancient oak. When he saw her crouch there in her fey garment made of leaves, he'd held a finger to his lips. He'd whispered to her not to move until it was safe. Then he climbed down and sent the king's men on their way, telling them there was no girl, and if they dared cut down one of the king's oaks, it would be on their heads, not his. Ridiculous story they'd told anyway, about this rushy cloak they sought, this girl who dressed in a sooty gown covered by a cloak of woven rushes, yet appeared before the king dressed like a princess in a series of gowns, each more beautiful than the last. Then she'd stolen the king's heart and fled with it. Preposterous. Yet there she'd been, clinging to the trunk, her bare feet bleeding and her eyes wide with fear but defiant all the same. Her cloak wasn't only rushes, though. Woven in by their stems were leaves of every kind, making her blend in so well it was a wonder he saw her at all. She'd refused to come down, even when the king's men had gone, so the young woodsman left his boots for her at the foot of the tree and returned home. With her feet bleeding like that, the king's hounds would find her soon enough, and he wouldn't have that on his conscience. But after dark, there was a soft scratching on his door, and there she was. To return his boots, she said. His cabin was within sight of the oak tree, so she'd been able to see where he'd gone well enough. She was ready to be off again, but he said she should at least eat something, at least stay the night, and that he'd never harm a hair on her head. She winced when she tasted his soup, and he knew why. There was no salt. He explained that salt was so dear that he'd gotten used to going without. He held out the little jar with only a pinch left, saying, "Take it and welcome." But she shook her head. "No," she said, "she was better off without. Salt was naught but trouble anyway." She told him then about that king she was running from. A man who'd treat a woman like a princess when she wore a gown as golden as the sun. But when that same woman made him bread soup and worked in his kitchens, she deserved nothing better than to have his boots thrown at her head. "It was better than her father, though," she said, as she took a walnut from the pocket of her ragged gown. He asked her what she meant by that, but she only shook her head. Beside his fire that very night, she opened the walnut, and impossibly, she drew out a rich gown. Golden as the sun it was. Stranger still, she asked him for a needle and a pair of scissors. Before his eyes, she began to unmake the lovely shining thing. Day after day, night after night she stayed, picking out every stitch until it was only pieces of cloth. Then she teased out each thread until there were only skeins of the finest shimmering gold. And when she was through, those days and nights days later, she unmade her rushy cloak. She eased each leaf free, releasing them into the air on a windy day. Then she separated the rushes, one from another, and remade them into a basket. For what good would any of them do her in this new life, she asked him. If he would only loan her his cloak and boots just for one day, she would trade the golden thread in the market. Even the king himself would never recognize the golden gown now. She would be free of the girl she had been before and start again. Of course, he said, putting a bowl of soup in front of her. Anything for you. Taste it, he said, as he handed her a spoon. I've made it special tonight. Oh, how he hoped his cooking could say what he couldn't find the words to. But now she was weeping into the soup he'd put that last pinch of salt into. What have I done wrong? He asked her, as she made the soup saltier still with her tears. Nothing, she said, squeezing his hand. I'll tell you tomorrow, when I've come back. And she made good on her promise, too. After a long day of wandering about in his stocking feet, feeling the emptiness of the tiny cabin he'd come to think of as theirs, not his alone, she returned at last. And as she made the soup and set it before him, she told him what she never had before, about the father who asked her how she loved him, how he'd raged and cast her out when she said, "I love you like meat loves salt." How he'd cursed and banished her. But had she really been so wrong? No, he said. She wasn't wrong at all. But what had she traded her thread for? She smiled. Taste your soup, she said. He did. And now it was his turn to weep. For instead of new boots she could wear to walk out of his life, or a knife, or a warm cloak, or 100 other things, she had traded her gold for a bag of salt. He was a man of few words, and the only one he could manage now was why. She put her arms around him. It is dear to you, she said. No, he told her. You are dear to me. And you are dear to me, love. She touched her forehead to his. Far too dear to do without. I love this twist on the traditional tale Kappa Rushes, which is kind of a what happens after the happy ever after kind of tale.
Yes, thank you so much, Lissa, for the story. She said she was inspired by the style of Jim Henson's The Storyteller, which we absolutely love.
Oh, yes, one of our all-time favourites. Martin and I like to dig those up on YouTube and watch them in bed sometimes.
Yep, we do.
I particularly like The Puppet Devils. I'm sure I've talked about those on Three Ravens before. I love them
so
much.
But you do really love them.
I do. And Lissa's new book has actually just come out.
Yes.
It's called Glass and Feathers, and it's a continuation of the Cinderella story. So if you enjoyed Worth His Salt and you're interested in finding out more, her website is lissasloane.com, so go and give that a look.
The Love Like Salt tale crops up in various versions, doesn't it?
Yes, it's folk tales of types 923 and 510, and it includes versions from England, Italy, Pakistan, Germany, India. It pops up all over the place. Yeah. I, of course, appreciate the resonances with Shakespeare's King Lear and the father demanding to know how much his children love him.
Yeah, the point of most versions of the tale is that the daughter loves her father as meat loves salt, which he takes as an insult, but he soon realises that meat is pretty bland without salt.
He realises this after having thrown her out and caused her to suffer all sorts of misfortune, but he gets there eventually. It's a journey. I've also always really loved the idea of the dress which folds up into a nutshell, so I really enjoyed that Lissa included that.
Well, it would make packing for a holiday much, much easier, wouldn't it?
Oh, wouldn't it? You could take so many extra clothes. Well, thank you again, Lissa, for a fabulous story. What have we got next?
Well, it's my turn. You ready?
I'm ready.
The Sleepers by Helen Lyons. They call for the doctor in late October, threading the needle's eye of time between autumn's brilliant display and the onslaught of the year's first snows. The thick and heavy flakes drift over the narrow mountain road, centuries old, bypassed by modern improvements, making the journey to the little village dangerous as winter approaches. By a combination of choice and neglect, this place was never incorporated, never built a school, never joined the fray of the Industrial Revolution. It stayed quietly hidden, time moving more slowly for them as they bore their children, some of whom left, some of whom returned, none who ever breathed a word of their existence, this New England Brigadoon. Everyone over the age of 55 must see the doctor, and anyone over 18 who has a significant illness in the last year must also be assessed. Young men injured during harvest, too weak to bring in the crops or slaughter the beef cows, those weakened by sickness and faintness, aches and pains beyond those which go hand in hand with their rural mountain life. A life scraped from the rocky hillsides, so unsuited to tilling and sowing. And yet somehow, in its own way, the village thrives. The doctor is kind. He comes from these people, though his twice yearly journeys here are his only visits back. He carries their secret with him as he goes about his work in Montpelier, the state's capital, so close to the lawmakers and modern folk who'd be horrified by what he does for these people. For sometimes he's successful, and sometimes he's not. But the villagers bury their dead quietly and never blame or question him, even as the rough slabs of rock wrested from the hillside find new purpose in the secluded cemetery, jutting from the earth like the petrified teeth of some prehistoric creature. Winter is grim and bleak in Vermont at the best of times, the world encased in ice and snow and grit, the air so dry and sharp that hands and lips and noses chap and bleed. Spring comes late, too. It's May before that mountain road is passable, when the doctor comes back again to undo what the villagers have done. Winter strikes a hard and deadly blow in this village up the mountain pass. The old and the weak feel it most keenly through their papery skin, their fragile bones, their thinned blood. The village would lose a dozen or more people each winter until 1816, the year with no summer, when so many more were ill and starving and near death. That October, a proposal was made. In fact, it was the doctor's own many times great-grandmother who made it. She had a bit of the witch about her, had knowledge of powwow medicine from her youth in Pennsylvania Dutch country. She'd learned from John George Homan himself long before he published his long-lost friend. She had healing that he'd never included in that book, taboo healing that would as quickly get you hanged as thanked. Her proposal was accepted and has been practiced these two centuries since. The villagers are assessed by the doctor in October, and then they make merry. Through late autumn, all thought of what will happen in the new year is dashed from their minds. The ones chosen by the doctor seem especially ready to cast off their cares, to dance, if they can, to eat the rich food that's saved from the harvest for just this time. December is more pagan than Christian in this little place, in keeping with the benighted death of the year, hope for the light's return, just that, a hope, not a guarantee, shored up by faith. At sunset on New Year's Day, when ice and snow have truly closed in and the wind wails, indistinguishable from the howls of wolves and the catamount, the chosen ones take their final nourishment, a broth whose recipe comes from the doctor's ancestor's own notebook, infused with herbs and roots gathered in the summertime. A last cup of earthy sunshine which brings a heavy, warm sleep. The chosen ones, most elderly, a few still young with future hopes, are dressed in simple, rough-spun shifts of hemp, and in their drug-worn stupor led outside to the village's center square. There they embrace the iron-hard earth, lying down side by side in a ring, feet to center, as the icy fire of the winter constellations glints down upon them. Men with rifles and torches encircle them, guarding them all night, keeping the mountain predators at bay as the sleepers' bodies slow down, laced up in winter's brittle threads. Just before sunrise, the cold of the star-burnished night has played its part. Hibernation has begun. The sleeper's skin has taken on a deathly waxen sheen, but faint edges of pink around the lips and cheeks signal the life within. The herbed drink prevents death by hypothermia, enclosing them instead in a welcome stasis free from pain and illness, from the hunger and privation that the next 4 months will bring. The sleepers are carried one by one to a windowless log house on the edge of the village green, where tall beds of cedar logs lined with evergreen boughs will receive them. They are set to rest in layers, three deep, separated by straw. A protective box is built around them, and the log house left alone until May. By May 10th, the mountain pass is clear and the earth soft enough to dig the graves that might be needed. The doctor returns. Water is boiled and steeped with herbs. The sleeper is placed in a tub hewn from hemlock, eased back to life in fragrant steam. Loved ones await the first audible breath, the first flicker of an eyelid, the press of a hand as pulses quicken. Those who do not awaken, whose lives remain in the barren clutch of winter, will find their place too, asleep up on the mountainside.
Whoa, what an unsettling story.
I know, right? So interesting. And the author of this piece, Helen, keeps a bit of a low profile on the Three Ravens social media a lot of the time, but she's been one of our most dedicated and kindest supporters, and we heart Helen.
We do, and we're also freaked out by her story, and that so much of the tale is based in fact.
Yeah, it's nuts, because Helen, with her story, sent basically footnotes, and in the body of her email, a series of links to further information about her story. The real newspaper articles from 1887, the truth behind it all, articles about the year without summer 1816, which we've talked about on the podcast before.
That same year that inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein, Lord Byron to write his poem Darkness, and Percy Bysshe Shelley to start planning Prometheus Unbound. So it was a big year for culture.
It was, and for people dying of starvation.
Also that.
Plus, Helen also supplied info about John George Holman's book of folk medicine, Powwows or The Long Lost Friend. I mean, not just was this story strange and unnerving and very folky, but it was researched.
It's very much the Three Ravens tradition.
Yep.
And it's a curious notion, isn't it? This idea of freezing people or putting them into suspended animation to save food and also serve as a sacrifice of sorts.
Oh, it's great. It's absolutely the kind of thing you can believe people tried too. I mean, I don't want to steal Helen's thunder here, but the story, while widely reported and an enduring piece of Vermont folklore, is widely accepted to be a hoax.
Oh, but that's exactly what outsiders would say, isn't it, Martin? Because they don't know the doctor and the things he can do, and they don't know about his ancient recipe.
Very true. And absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Still, is it time for another story?
It is indeed, and it's my turn. The Hatching of Mammy Slack by Libby Justice. On a day when the sky lay like a black, scratchy blanket across the village, Mammy Slack slithered from between her mother's legs and landed on the bed with a thump. Whether it was lack of sunlight or because of Mr. Slack's leaden heart, Mammy was born grey. She had dull, puffy skin, sparse, mousy hair, and eyes that pointed in different directions. The ladies of the village filed past the crib, trying their hardest to hide their disappointment. Nobody finished their cup of tea. Of the girl's strange eyes, only the wisest and most ancient of the crones, Ada Doody, had anything bright to say. "One mud-bound, one heaven-bound. How interesting!" Mrs. Slack, who was called Yvetta, had longed to call her first daughter after one of the garden flowers she loved so much. Rose, columbine, violet, peony. Yet, when she looked at the sleeping, spud-like lump in her arms, her heart stalled, and she could only think of her child as the baby. The baby grew more solid and more square. She neither cried nor smiled. Yvetta would sit her on the kitchen tiles while she cooked and washed. There the girl would remain, blinking but not looking, breathing but not moving. Day after day, Mrs. Slack would chatter to her child about the weather, cake mixtures, or the changing colours in the garden. Just silence. Just nothing. On the baby's fifth birthday, she uttered, "Mammy." Mrs. Slack cried with relief. It was the only word the girl ever spoke, the only word she ever claimed as her own. In time, it became her name. Mr. Slack was a man whose body ate and slept in the house, but whose soul lived elsewhere. He passed through, a shadow that smelled of beer in the week and whiskey on Saturdays. Lonely Yvetta, yearning to care for something warm and alive, built a chicken pen and filled it with silky russet hens who scratched and bustled and made beautiful noises. One day, Mammy lifted herself from the hearth and stumped out to the pen. Her mother never recalled showing the girl how to work the latch, but she found her late in the morning, sitting with a plump hen in her lap, stroking its feathers with fat, gentle fingers. After that, Mammy was always to be found in the coop. She would pace slowly, picking up stray feathers and stuffing them in her pockets, or sit with a hen, slowly tracing the patterns of its wings with her mud-bound eye. Sometimes at dusk, Mrs. Slack found Mammy perched on the lowest branches of the apple tree, roosting between dozing birds. Mrs. Slack felt lightened. At last, Mammy was in the sunshine. She took out her needles and thread. If she couldn't have a girl named for flowers, she would make frocks in poppy red and delphinium blue. Mammy wore them wordlessly. They came back at night, covered in dust and chicken shit. Mammy started school. She sat at her desk and years of learning floated above and around her. No one liked her or disliked her. Hers was merely a chair that was already taken. At home, Mrs. Slack was never sure how Mammy learned to bend and cut wire or hammer pieces of wood together. But slowly, the pen grew bigger. Mrs. Slack brought new hens back from the market. Golden honey-coloured hens, silver speckled hens, and hens as black as coal dust. Sometimes, Mammy's heaven-bound eye would flicker up towards a passing rook, or in the fading light of dusk, the ghostly shadow of an owl. Then Mammy would blink, grunt, and stump back to the coop. The years rolled by. Cocks and hens were loved and lost, always buried carefully, and marked silently with a hand-tied cross of sticks. Then, things happened. One morning, Mrs. Slack packed up her recipes, her seed twists, and her best silk shirt into a small brown leather case. In the coop, she found Mammy curled up in a bed of straw. Silently, she kissed her child's sleeping head. And then she left. That night, Mammy sat like a stone on the old kitchen tiles, while Mr. Slack raged around the house in a fog of ale fumes. Out of the door and into the black night he went, tearing up the flower beds, smashing herb-filled pots, and clawing at the chicken pen door till his hands were streaked with blood. Finally, beaten, he crashed upstairs and fell into bed, just as a passing fox was creeping into the coop. One by one, the villagers were awoken by a flying whisper that there was blood and death at the Slack house. The ladies donned their serious hats and headed round to be of use. Mr. Slack lay upstairs in a pile of stale, stained sheets. Mammy was nowhere to be seen. Ada Doody, in her cottage on the edge of the bluebell wood, watched with twinkling eyes as Mammy Slack rested a ladder against the body of an ancient oak. Hefting a great bundle wrapped in sheeting onto her back, Mammy started to climb. As Ada brewed her tea, Mammy climbed slowly onto the oak's lowest limbs. The tea leaves swirled and Mammy climbed. At last, as Ada added a dash of milk, Mammy came to rest on a branch almost as high as the clouds. Swaying slightly in the breeze, she unraveled the sheet to reveal two great wings, hawk wings of wire and feathers. In the morning light, the feathers danced and shone, honey gold, silver speckled, and black like coal dust. Mammy strapped them to her back, glanced skywards, and then leapt into the glittering morning sky. Catching the breeze, she beat her wings and flew toward the sun. Ada smiled. Ah, she thought, heaven bound after all.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow, what an unusual story.
I really loved how original this story was. Thank you so much, Libby. I don't think I've ever come across a character like Mammy Slack before. Mm. This girl with an affinity to chickens in the coop, who's silent, biding her time, until the moment she decides she's going to fly.
I like the dual aspect of Mammy's personality depicted in her eyes, like one mud-bound, one heaven-bound.
Yeah, one side being very practical and good at looking after the chickens and building the coop and carefully making her wings, and then the other side just always thinking about flying away.
It's quite a powerful metaphor for growing up as well, isn't it? And the basis for a lot of the best buildings roman narratives, that you can't really become your true adult self until you leave your parents or whatever the status quo world may be behind you.
I always enjoy a character who's not afraid to get muddy and dirty.
Yeah.
I love the image of Mammy getting all her beautiful flower-coloured dresses covered in chicken poop and mud.
What Eleanor isn't saying is that she actually identifies very strongly with these characters because she's nearly always got mud on her somewhere and stuff in her hair.
I can't deny it. Mud is attracted to me.
Libby also had some beautiful descriptions of chickens in her story. I've never really thought of chickens as being especially pretty birds, but the descriptions of feathers in Mammy's wings, they were lovely.
Yeah, they said they're gold and silver and coal black. Yeah. It was really lovely. And our next tale's also about animals, isn't it?
Well, sort of. Here we go. The Hare's Breath by Dominic Bailey. Marble eyes stare blindly from the skull hanging on the cabin wall, the carcass it once commanded, now a matted twist of leathery hide. Candlelight flickers in the glassy eyes, which reflect a shadow hunched over the workbench, slowly pushing a whetstone across a blade. The slow drag of stone on steel grates and squeals, but its bearer pays no heed. Mumbling through cracked lips, he mutters broken phrases, a staccato of spittle accompanying the slow strokes of his work. The knife's edge, dull and dirty, resists. Once razor sharp, it had served him well, slicing through flesh and sinew as though drawn through water. Skin unpeeled at its slightest touch, spilling guts and gore from their hold. Life severed in an unflinching moment. But it will come. Stone on steel drags again and again and again. Moonlight casts cold shadows on walls where instruments of death and the victims of their murderous score hang side by side. Traps, guns, hooks and snares alongside feathers, pelts and hides that once breathed life into the woods outside. The man mumbles. A curse? A prayer? Or just the patter of an old rhyme to keep out the cold and darkness? A low grumble against the world outside, a rhyme, a curse, and a prayer. In a swish of black fur, a cat jumps onto the workbench, startling the man. The stone slips and the knife edge slides along his thumb, drawing a dark line that starts to seep and drip onto the wooden surface. "Bloody cow, I should skin you," the man shouts and swipes the animal away. As his arm swings, drops of blood fly across the room, peppering the walls. A cloud veils the moonlight, and as the cat edges through the door into the night, an icy breath of wind snuffs the candle. Darkness. Cursing, the man holds his thumb to his mouth as he scrambles for matches. He tastes iron and dirt as he finds a box and blindly fumbles for matches. He strikes. Shadows dance as he lights the wick. Wrapping a torn piece of cloth around his thumb, he picks up the stone and turns back to the knife. Scrape, scrape, scrape. The cloud passes, moonlight returns to the walls and the glassy eye blinks. The green ball glistens in the half-light. The taut leather of a long-forgotten hide softens and fills out. Small cracks from within sound like bones clicking into place. Bald patches regrow pure white hair as if spun forward in double time until a glossy coat shimmers in the silver kiss of the moon. Then it drops, barely a sound as soft pads land on the floorboards. Just a mutter and scrape behind the hunched shadow at the bench. The white hare rubs a paw over her nose and looks around the cabin. She blows a soft breath to the pelt above the fireplace. Limbs twist and her head turns back to the way it was meant to face.
A dirty brown coat shakes and then shines a reddy orange of sunsets, lava and stone. Fox lands gently next to Hare. She blows a soft breath to the mass of black feathers on the door. A ripple, then a wing stretches down and back. A shake, and the black raven drops to the floor and stands beside the other two. The Hare blows a soft breath towards the hulking frame, and the scraping stone stumbles once more, feeling the hairs on the back of his neck rise as if someone was standing very close, leaning in for a whisper. The man turns. His breath catches, cutting short the muttering as he sees the three figures. Shadows of light, shimmering, solid and aglow. A fox, a raven, and a hare. Instinct kicks him out of his stupor and he dives for the hare, but his hands clasp as he flails at thin air. Turning back to the table, he grabs the knife and lunges at the fox, slashing, willing the blade to pierce flesh and crunch on bone, but nothing. He rubs his eyes and, with a slow drawing of breath, opens them again. Still, they are there, staring at him. Their gaze burns, not just with the reflection of the dancing candle, it burns into him. A storm whips up behind his own eyes, pain searing through his brain, and he clasps his hands to his ears as if they might block out the rushing wind. He tries the rhyme, the prayer, the curse for protection, but the torment in his head is too wild. "See," a voice in the whirlwind. "See what you have done." In the blinding storm, he sees animals leaping. Bucks with proud antlers, does with their young, twisting and exploding into fire. Rabbits and foxes race before him into burning nets. Birds struggle to launch themselves into the air as red-hot chains hold them down. All vanish, engulfed in balls of flame. And each burst sends a bolt of anguish and pain into his very core. He sinks to his knees, fingers clawing at his face, tearing at his eyes to make the visions stop. And in an instant, a blinding flash, the air is sucked from the cabin in a roar. Then, silence. The fox stands, nudges open the door with his nose and trots into the wood. The raven, a ruffle of feathers, a quick preen, and he lifts into the night sky, a purple shadow rising into the moonlight. The hare sits a while, still looking at the man. "No more," she whispers, turns and leaves. White as the snow that covers the ground, she, too, is gone. In the cabin, marble eyes stare blindly from the skull of the kneeling figure on the floor. His leathery face is twisted in a frozen scream. Not a sound from his lips, not a prayer, not a curse, not a rhyme, not even a breath. Thank you so much for that, Dominic. A nice piece of folk horror right up my street. Should come with the subtitle, Taxidermy Strikes Back.
Yeah, taxidermy is one of those things that we both struggle with a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, in old-fashioned museums, when I see animals behind cases, sometimes I think, wow. But most of the time, the sight of all those creatures makes me feel sad. Like all those racks of butterflies you come across from time to time, they're kind of amazing. But also,
the butterflies.
And I can appreciate the artistry and the skill that goes into creating good taxidermy, 100%. And I think back before we had film cameras and David Attenborough and the like, you can see that taxidermy served a special purpose educationally. But today, the only taxidermied items I really care to look at in museums are the animals that no longer exist. Mm. Like the dodo, for example. You see one of them and you go, well, that's a dodo.
Yeah, and then recall that the only reason we don't have dodos anymore is because human beings literally ate every last dodo.
True, but also, I mean, we, and this is a personal thing, but both Martin and I also struggle with zoos a little bit, don't
we? Yeah, we do a bit. I mean, sometimes when nature reserves are looking after endangered animals or engaged in breeding programs for endangered creatures and so on, I can see their benefits, but often going to the zoo makes me feel sad for the animals. They so often feel like animal prisons. And my view might be simplistic about all this, and I might be wrong, but it's how I usually feel.
And then when you go to museums with all the glass tanks full of taxidermied animals, you think, well, this is like a really rubbish animal prison. Sorry, a really rubbish zoo where the inmates can't even move.
Which begs the question, would it be better if we had robot animals in museums?
Well, you know, I think yes. I mean, robot dinosaurs at museums and theme parks are one of my favourite things to see. But better yet, as Dominic has presented in his story, is the concept of taxidermy coming back to life and taking revenge.
Yeah, I would love for the hare in this story to pitch up on a late night talk show, you know, like Kick Back with Seth Meyers, or Stephen Colbert or Graham Norton, cigarette dangling from the edge of his mouth, and talk it all through.
Life is hard for me out in the wild. But you know what's harder, Stephen? It's being killed and mounted for the public's pleasure, being dead and looked at. So now I'm happy to be dead and alive again and being looked at to remind the good folks at home, don't kill animals for fun. Simple message. And buy local where you can and support the arts. Thanks very much.
Cue rapturous applause.
And there's definitely an environmental angle to the story, isn't there? I think Mervyn, who wrote last week's Herne the Hunter story, would get along well with Dominic. I think they'd be friends. I think he should be friends.
I'd like to think that everyone who listens to The Three Ravens would be friends if they met in real life.
Me too. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Wouldn't it? And again, I might be wrong about that, like I might be wrong about zoos, but I don't think I am. I think the Three Ravens community is full of really cool and nice people.
Me too. And so shall I read another story written by just such a Three Ravens community member?
Yes, please.
The Selkie's Daughter by Alicia Holston. Since 6 years since our man left, stealing away in the middle of the night, her sealskin clutched tight to her breast so she may never lose it again. 6 years, 74 cycles of the moon, each one a reminder that she's gone, returned to the sea, leaving behind the life she built on land. I remember the night as if it were carved into rock by the wind and the rain. She came to our room crying, tears of sorrow and joy, mixed in eyes as deep and dark as the sea itself. I'd seen the longing in her every time we went out fishing in our tiny boat, her eyes scanning the sea for signs of her old life, life with the rest of her Selkie kin. The ocean called to her in ways human hearts couldn't comprehend, but I knew. There are few reasons Selkies shed their skin and walk among humans, have families dirt side. None are pleasant. In the case of our mother, she'd been dancing under a full moon with her sisters when a fisherman, my father, stole her sealskin. He promised her freedom after 7 years, a bargain sealed with marriage and children. We, my brother Rab and I, were the fruits of that agreement. She taught us to swim and to catch fish. I'm better than my brother, but Ma was the best fisher in our village and the strongest swimmer. She hid it, though, and told me to do so as well. Men don't like women who show them up, Myra, my girl. You have the dark of the sea in your eyes. I cannae help but see it. But hush now, lass. Hide it well. The world be cruel to those deemed different. No one else knew her secret. Or at least, I don't think they did. She was so very careful. However, when we go out in our boat, The seals would swim alongside us, close enough that Ma would reach out her hand and caress their heads. She'd tell them the village news and how we were doing, her voice a gentle murmur of a language I didn't understand. Our fishing trips were bittersweet to me. The rhythmic slap of waves against the hull calmed my restless spirit, but the sight of the sleek grey heads of the seals breaching the surface sent my heart aflutter with what I once thought anxiety, but now I know it to be longing. My brother Rab, younger by 2 years, has always seemed content with his dark-side life. He has a fine hand for carving wee boots, making them like the one our father uses for fishing. For me, our fishing boat is a constant reminder of the family I never knew and the mother I lost. But for Rab, it's a symbol of the future he'll have someday. He's our past son, through and through. The rising and falling tides don't thrum in his veins like they do in mine. In the past 2 years, I found myself missing her more and more. I find myself at the shoreline, scanning the surface of the sea for signs she's near. I was sure I saw her a few months ago while I was out in the boat. She swam up to me and we locked eyes. She let me touch her and she nuzzled my hand. The fishing was exceptionally good that day, and I know in my heart it was an unspoken gift from my own Ma. There are other signs too, from the words she spoke to me those years ago, to finding a slight webbing between my fingers starting around my 13th birthday. I can hold my breath longer than any other village kid, but I don't let on. I hide the signs, especially around my Da. He already gets sad when I'm around because I remind him so much of my Ma, same build, same hair and same dark eyes. He gets angry when he finds me by the sea, after realising my bed's empty in the middle of the night. Sometimes I think he knows my secret, suspects I'm more like my Ma than I let on. Last night, I dreamt that I was swimming with the seals, that I was one of them. Despite my human legs and scrawny arms, I was free and felt I was finally at home. She was there, and my aunts were with her too. I woke up crying when I found myself back in bed, motherless on land. The dream was so real. The salt in my tears tasted just like the sea, and my hair was damp with sweat or something. I was broken-hearted to leave the dream and my seal family behind. However, I know one day soon I'll join them. After all, I'll be 14 next year. Now, I love a Selke tale, but Alicia's particularly resonated with me. I'm not sure I've come across that many Selkie tales written from the perspective of the children.
No, actually. We usually see them either narrated by the Selkie wife herself or the husband who's cheekily stolen her skin away.
I thought that Alicia beautifully captured the sense of yearning in the child left behind, always feeling different to the other village children and missing her mother terribly. There's a very personal aspect to this story too, so thank you so much for sharing it with us, Alicia.
Now, the Selkie tale type is a great way to explore grief, I think. Both that of the Selkie bride for the lost aspect of herself, which ultimately proves too powerful to ignore, but for the people left behind who perhaps might want to follow but feel a responsibility to their families and the dirt side life.
Yes. I thought it was very touching how Myra starts to remind her father of her lost mother as she gets older, but he still can't accept that she's so like her that one day she too is going to go back to the sea.
Well, Selkies were very popular in our folky flash fiction submissions, weren't they?
They were, and we couldn't read all of the Selkie stories we were sent, but thank you to everybody who was inspired by these amazing creatures. We certainly enjoyed finding out all about their folklore and origins for our bestiary episode a few months ago, so it's easy to see why they inspired so many people.
Well, our next entry is actually also a Selkie tale.
Oh, fantastic. Let's have it.
Tide Father by Jermaine Heifer. The reeds and rushes speak. How? By being inhabited. Inhabited by the river and air currents, by waterfowl and fish, by seal skin. Listen with a wild ear untamed by language and you will hear. Just as the Selkie knows his seal pelt, his real skin is hidden amongst the reeds, waiting for retrieval when he's done in a land-loving form, so you know the whisper and call of stalks and leaves and seed heads. You know it, but you have to remember to listen. Purifying the river and homing myriad creatures. Tidefather listened to the water and its open destiny. He watched the sea and he heard the sun and moon dreams of the breeze around halyards and canvas. The dance of waves was etched on his bones, a living scrimshaw that informed his moves in time with the tides. But don't be imagining your own projection of a salt dog idyll. For all his water-listening ways, he'd forgotten the language of reed speak and what lay hidden within. Tidefather had entangled himself with a land love. He'd tied himself to the mast of a dream and forgotten how to untie the knots. You know about Selkies, of course. Of the seals who can't help themselves from wanting another life. He saw her on the shore, fell for the dream, and slipped off his sealskin to court her in a form matching her own. He enjoyed the sensuous smoothness of human skin. Hers was polished like a pale river pebble, still shining with sunlight in water. He didn't fear shedding his pelt, for he knew it well concealed in the reed mace, knew he could slip it back on and swim home when the fantasy began to fade. But since when are dreams and dreamers so well behaved? Neither is renowned for following rules. And our Selkie man was hooked to a life on land. He was entangled in the ropes of his dream with the ears of his human form, ears that eschewed the hushed voices of bulrushes. Tidefather danced with his dream of love, counted his land-bound blessings, and, having travelled from the depths to pathways and clifftops, always had one eye on the water's edge. But this Selkie hadn't been prepared for the strength of the knots a sailor can tie. This sailor tied himself firm to his boats for shore. His blood recognized the rhythm of waves. His horizon was cast deep, and he moved with ease on small dinghy and navy ship alike. Better for him, perhaps, if he had fallen seaward. But he had tied his sailor knots too firmly to oak, plank and pole, to meadow and hill, to his lady of the land. With a ring on her finger and one earth babe after one other swelling within, without knowing it, she always called him ashore. Shh, don't listen to the whisper from the rushes. Forgetting is so easy, but we may never forget that something is asking to be remembered. Father Tide may not have recalled where he stowed his seal skin, or even that he had one, but he knew something was missing. He could count every penny in his accounts, every fact that was ever relayed to him, but there was always a discrepancy, something was always astray.
No matter how many wildflowers he gathered with his children, there were never enough. Father Tide felt himself sucked towards some truth just beyond his reach. He could smell it in the low tide silt and the high tide salt, but his hands were too slow to seize it. They didn't slide through air the way his thoughts did through water. What was the wet truth he sought? He wanted to find it in his wife, his daughter, his son. He searched for it in high society and below decks, at dances and around anchors. He knew it was fluid and rich, and it smelt of home. It was warm in the cold ebb and comforting on the muddy edge. So he reached for the liquid that soothed his naked soul, and he drank what he thought was the answer. The whiskey brought him dreams of freedom, but it didn't speak a language he could understand, and he couldn't hear the truth. The estuary reeds told him of his long cast-off skin, but he was too drunk on his new life to hear. There had been a time in between who he was and what he'd become when Father Tide had flowed with his land life. The joy of love and land and liquid lunches were compelling, but now he was ebbing with the levels in the decanter and he didn't know why. Father Tide never did untie those sailors' knots. He loosened them when he swam in the shallows and steered a tiller, but his land family always pulled at the ends, securing the rope with which he tied himself ashore. The whiskey stored whispering memories, so he pressed his ear to the glass and listened. There he heard displaced waves and lost tides, felt water weeds brush by, and so there is where he dived. Not into the river to reclaim his pelt, he dove into a darker liquid and found a different truth. It wasn't the one he was looking for, but who's to say it was wrong? Perhaps when the whiskey took his shaking hand that last time, he saw his yearned-for journey home. Saw the River Stour converge with the Styx as the boatman ferried him away, away to a ghost of a sealskin tucked amongst the reeds for safekeeping. The rushes are more inhabited than you know to look at. Attune your ears. Give the listening your stillness and time, and you may hear the memory of Father Tide. Slick fur sliding through water near the family he loved.
Such a sad and powerful story, that one.
It is dealing with some real stuff. And although nobody needs to know this to enjoy the story, Jermaine originally wrote the story for her mum as a healing retelling of her dad's life and early death.
Whoa, so Jermaine's dad was a Selkie?
Well, maybe. Certainly, I think Jermaine's implication in the story is that life for him was a real struggle. And as Jermaine said in her email, it's a story originating from folk motifs, meaning it can be connected with on different levels by different people.
Well, at times we can all associate with that idea of knowing someone for whom life just doesn't seem to fit. Mm. And you can see how in the past people ended up labelled and outcast and scapegoated for that kind of thing.
Of course, it's a classic feature of witch stories, but also fae stories and tales of changelings and the like. People thought to be half giant or whatever the case may be.
And some people are just magic people, aren't they?
She says, being a magical person.
Well, you likewise, you're freaky. the way you see things coming, or have these uncanny bits of intuition. He does.
Well, let's not muck about. Life can be hard if you're a bit out of step with the world. And I think life can also be quite difficult for people in families or friendship groups with people who are a bit other in whatever way that might manifest. That comes down to the golden rule, though, doesn't it?
Yes, treat others as you'd like to be treated. Mm-hmm. One of the oldest moral lessons in all human culture, yet one that many people brush under the carpet.
Or drown down by the whispering reeds, which is part of why I love that story very much, Jermaine, because it shows huge kindness to its subjects. If anyone writes about me when I'm gone, knowing I'm a bit difficult at times, I hope they do so with that much kindness.
And so that leads us to our final winning story. Let's do this. The Rowan by Sophie Thompson. I told him we shouldn't move there, but he wouldn't listen. We came to Elversford in September. The air was still warm, too warm for that time of year. But the nights drawing in betrayed autumn's coming. John had wanted to go since he saw it on the telly. He'd wanted to get out of the city for years, get a small holding somewhere and grow vegetables and the like. We both worked from home anyway, we could do that from anywhere. We could move south. I didn't think it would actually happen. Oh, I wish we hadn't gone. We got a place on the edge of the hamlet. Quaint cottage, half brick, half wooden boarding, those old casement windows with the lead crisscrosses. It was the last line of defence between the other houses and the salt marsh. There was nothing else in Elversford but a handful of the same, all picturesque and huddled at the bottom of a densely wooded hill. John was excited, said we should make the most of it. That place put me on edge. The green tufts of grass on the marsh were cleaved open by the tides. The channels cut through the land, leaving festering, muddy wounds. I didn't like how they ran with the estuary's blood twice a day. The tides snuck up on you, slithering in. It was often silent, except for the odd call of a godwit or a knot. The locals told us that if we were lucky enough, we could see the eels winding through those silty gashes. Lucky indeed. John said not to think about the eels. She first came on the 21st of September. I remember because she told us it was the equinox. She popped her head over the garden wall. Her skin was crinkled, her flint eyes glinting in the setting sun. Her wispy blonde curls seemed to writhe and stand on end, even though there wasn't a lick of a breeze. She asked where our accents were from. What we missed most about home, proper curry sauce for our fish and chips. And could we cut down that old rowan in the front garden? It was overhanging and making it hard for her to get down her path. John said we were still getting settled and would take a look when we could. She asked again a week later. John was a bit peeved that time. Said if she wanted to chat about it, she should come to our door. Anyway, he said we'd get round to it. Later, I told him to be careful. You don't piss off the local hag, it never ends well. He told me not to be so silly. I wish he'd listened. The next week was the final straw. She came to our gate and asked for the rowan to be cut down. By this point, John had had enough. It was his tree, and he'd do what he liked with it. She told John to mark her words well. We blow-ins were not welcome. We'd be out of that house by the end of the month. I begged him to go over and make amends, but he was having none of it. Soon after, the happenings began. They started small, like the first trickles of the tide coming in. The kale we planted was savaged by slugs. The blackberries withered and soured overnight. Just bad luck, John said. Then our chickens dropped down dead, one by one. He said it was probably coccidiosis. Next, the cat. One minute she was drinking from her water bowl. The next she was coughing and shaking. We thought it was just a furball until she retched up a blood clot the size of a crab apple, thick and glistening crimson. When we looked, the water in her bowl was foul and muddy, smelling of fish guts and iron. I had my suspicions, but I didn't dare speak them into existence. What good would it have done? It came to a head the night of the storm. The wind whipped through the woods on the hill, hissing and whispering, and rolled down to us, rippling the pools collecting in the mudflats. The rowan branches tapped on the window, and the rain beat an incessant thrum on the roof that I'd normally find soothing. I told John that I wanted to go, that my nerves were bad. He said I'd never given Elversford a chance. I shouldn't let my fear of some bossy old woman get to me. He just wanted us to have a nice life, and I was ruining it. Suddenly, a vile filth began spewing from the kitchen plug hole. At first, it was silt from the marsh, then blood and raw pink flesh and fine feathery bones. Then whole eels spilled out, thrashing and glugging, filling the sink and overflowing onto the tiles. And that smell, God, the stench! Iron and blood and rotting fish. John's face was green, his eyes like saucers. But more horrible a sight was behind him. For over his shoulder I could see her pale face grinning at the living room window, framed by the black swirling night. Her wiry curls writhed on her head like dank worms above her wide, wild eyes. And her grin, a sneering, ghoulish gash across her papery skin. The rest of her faded into the storm, but that smile lingered like breath against the glass. John burst into life, lunging towards the front door to make after her. Her figure lurked by the garden gate, that terrible grin still hewn on her face. I begged him to come back inside, but at that moment there was a deafening crack as the rowan split in two. A flash of blood-red berries and jagged white splinters came crashing down. John fell too. Not half wanting to, I looked back down the garden. I didn't need to peer through the gloom. She was there. She hadn't moved an inch. She was still smiling. I'll confess, I was instantly drawn to this story, as rowans are one of my favourite trees. Mm. Our house is actually Rowan Tree Cottage, and we have a rowan outside the front, which is just coming into bud at the moment.
I really sincerely hope our rowan tree doesn't follow the example of the one in that story.
No!
I really enjoyed how Sophie subverted the thing which is a dream for a lot of people, getting a piece of land and starting a small holding and living completely self-sufficiently. She turned that into a total nightmare.
Me too. I'm also quite disturbed by eels. So the moment the eels spilled out of the plug hole made me absolutely shudder. So congratulations, Sophie. You've successfully fueled my nightmares for weeks to come.
Now, I always think that's a good way to start writing a scary story. Choose something which scares you and you have a good chance of scaring your audience too.
Yes, maybe. Sophie, have you had an experience with eels? Sophie's story actually brought to mind some of the tales I've heard about haunted houses where families move in all hopeful and then a series of strange things start happening. What was that farm in Wales where the animals started going mad?
Yeah, Hail Vanna.
It sort of reminded me of that, this idea of the smallholding dream becoming poisoned. Mm,
on the other hand, they say you should always give a witch what she asks for. And I do think in this instance, that could have served our young couple well.
Yes, if one of your neighbours, who also is a bit hag-like, repeatedly asks you to cut down a tree, maybe you should listen to him, or at least get a mediator from the local council to help you discuss it civilly.
Thank you so much for your great story, Sophie. And one day, Eleanor and I will stop rocking backwards and forwards and muttering about eels coming up our plug holes.
I'll be right back. I'm just going to check all the sinks again.
So, resounding well done to Lissa, Helen, Libby, Dominic, Alicia, Jermaine and Sophie. Thank you so much for entering the competition, for writing such lovely stories and entertaining so many members of the Three Ravens community.
Yes, thank you all so much. And well done for being winners of the competition. Mm-hmm. It was a difficult one to judge because so many people wrote such interesting, thought-provoking and emotional stories.
Like we said earlier, though, news on the next writing competition is coming next week in Series 4, Episode 0 and Episode 1, where we are headed back to Suffolk.
Bring it on. And as ever, if you haven't already, please review the podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And do email us with your local or interesting folklore at threeravenspodcast@gmail.com for our next listener episode.
Likewise, do please join us on social media if you haven't already at facebook.com/threeravenspodcast, Instagram @threeravenspodcast, and on Twitter @threeravenspod. I realise I haven't been posting very much lately, but I'm firing the folklore furnace, stoking those flames, and we'll be back on it with a vengeance very soon.
And lastly, if you would like to support the podcast and access tons of exclusive content from last week's Patreon exclusive episode for April, Three Lost Villages, to next week's Film Club episode about men, to dozens of other delightful things,
ad free episodes, Monday episodes early, stories as text versions, chances to chat with lovely people and vote on cool stuff,
do sign up for $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/threeravenspodcast.
And please send us emails about men, the film, not the whole gender identity, or even specific men, just the film, please.
I mean, you can send emails about specific men, but we might not include them on the podcast about the cinematic endeavour, men.
Yeah, but please email us about the film, men, to threeravenspodcast@gmail.com by Monday the 22nd. And in the meantime, while your stories have gone that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle till you're out of the woods. Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour. And our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, produced by me, Martin Vaughs. Thanks for listening.
God send every gentleman such hounds, such hawks, and such leman with a down, derry, derry, derry.